welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. It is the 6th, can you believe it? Hardly the 6th of September 2020 when we're airing this live, because we'll probably air it again. So if you feel like you're time traveling, you are.
Yeah.
Except for today. Today you're not time traveling.
That's correct.
Well, I mean, how do I know that, though? Really?
Yeah. How do you know you weren't already here?
All right, Bill.
All right.
Do we have a sponsor today?
Yeah, we do. Our sponsor is Papit Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And if you need John Deere Ag equipment, you need John Deere Turf equipment, you need Honda, you need steel, they've got it all down there. Go by and see them. And, or give them a call, 226-9226, and they can get you fixed up. Or you can get them on the web at
what?
www.papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There you go.
Well, isn't that fun?
Yeah. So there you go. Don't stare at me like that. Don't give me that eye.
I never get tired of doing that.
Yeah.
I don't. I just never get tired of it. It's like, say something, Bill, and it's like,
stop looking at me.
See him like locking up like children in the backseat of a car. It's not good.
He's touching me.
That's actually really not good. I knew you were going there, though. So we're continuing a conversation today, which should frighten you. But it's something that really needs to be chatted about, because I actually was it was last night. They had somebody on TV, I think it was Rand Paul, and they said, well, who's funding all of this, you know, all these protests and all this anarchy? And he's like, well, I don't know, but we should get to the bottom of it. And I thought, gee whiz, he should call our guest, William Kay, or listen to our show, or do both. Because we did a show on this last week, so we just, I guess I just wasn't feeling very clever. I just called this Black Lives Matter, the Ford Foundation, and the Black Movement Oligarchy Part 2. With our guest, William Kay. He lives in Alberta, Canada, and started with a radio program, go figure that out, and was doing all sorts of things on environmentalism. And his website is ecofascism.com. So before you're thinking, well, I don't know if I care about environmentalism, no, you do, because there's a whole bunch of other stuff besides that on there. And it's very interesting how the tactics and the personnel and all that of the hard environmental left, for anybody who's lived anywhere where they've, you know, had spotted owls or longhorn beetles or any other stupid thing we've got to save that.
Red-legged frogs.
Oh, yeah, red-legged frogs.
Fairy shrimp.
You've encountered these people, and now we're watching them take this to a whole new level. I guess they went after the Kentucky Derby today. I'm assuming that didn't go well.
That was yesterday.
That was yesterday?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's Sunday. They don't do Kentucky Derby on Sunday, do they? Yeah. Well, maybe they do. You know, it's the virus. Everything that's screwed up.
They had it yesterday without a crowd. There was nobody in the stands, which seems kind of odd to me.
Because you can't be outside and watch a horse race?
Yeah,
or
no,
a horse
no
thing?
You can't. No,
it's not
can't.
Really a race.
You might sit next to somebody accidentally and breathe on them. Yeah, terrible.
Touching.
Yeah, I don't think they wanted to mess around with the folks in Kentucky. I think that might have been a bad move.
Huh. Well, I guess we all need to be more like the folks in Kentucky, huh? So, Mr. Kay, I know we sort of asked a lot of questions and derailed you from your super good plan last week.
I no longer live in Alberta.
Oh, you don't?
I have moved. Yeah. Yes, I moved back to my homeland, Saskatchewan.
Oh, that's hard.
To an undisclosed location.
No, Saskatchewan.
Oh, okay.
We're dying in Saskatchewan. Come get me. And it's good to be back. I've been away for a long, long time. This is where I'm from originally.
Is it a... okay, so obviously I don't speak Canadian. So is Saskatchewan a town or a place, like a region?
It is a province.
Okay.
Much as you have states,
yeah.
This is a province. The provinces go from west to east, British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan.
Okay.
So we're third in. We're directly north of Montana. Probably about where I'm right now, about 500 miles northwest of Fargo, North Dakota, just to give you a location you might be familiar with.
Wow.
But we're north of there. Yeah. The Saskatchewan border also touches a bit on the North Dakota border.
Huh.
So just if you can think North Dakota, Montana, and just think directly north. In fact, the city I'm in right now, Regina, is quite close to the U.S. border.
Oh, okay. well, that's kind of fun. Okay, okay. Yeah. I'll get rid of Alberta in there.
Yeah, it's good to get out of Alberta. It's in dire straits.
Oh, is it really?
Double whammy, the COVID. But it was, Saskatchewan's a far more diversified economy than Alberta is. Alberta, although they talked about diversification for the last 50 years, they certainly never practiced it. They are almost entirely dependent on the oil patch and the collapse of the oil price, and then the COVID, it's really knocked it out of them. The provincial government is now borrowing 60% of its budget, 60.
Wow.
Oh, well, I'm sure that'll work out.
So how much of that is timber?
Timber in Alberta?
Yeah.
Less than 5%.
Oh, wow.
And is...
It's really oil and gas. So, see, all the western provinces have dubbed some timber industry. Like, there's unlimited forests here. But
we don't want to use it.
Harvest them.
Yeah, it's just like here. But yeah, it's
interesting. We'd rather watch them burn, you know.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. You can't even see the other side of our town today. It's it looks like somebody threw a blanket over the whole place. Kind of a brown, ugly, furry blanket.
It's a travesty.
Yeah.
You know, the amount that we lose in fires that they could be burning, and they say, well, how are we going to stop these fires? Well, why don't we just clear the forest, you know, and move in, farmers and what have you. I mean, it's not as though there's any sort of shortage of timber out there. Certainly not in this country. The timber harvest in Canada is 1 over 400. It's 1/400 of the actual forest mass. And forest is considered old growth in Canada if it's over 100 years. So we could quadruple the harvest, and we still would not make a dent in it.
It's interesting in here. I don't know. I think the concept of old growth, it just means if it's a tree. You know, they used to talk about it with meaning, but now it's just if it's a tree. Well, it's old growth. I had someone tell me that. I'm like, really?
To the environmentalist, it was a pretty tree.
Ooh.
You know, it was cathedral stands, which are quite often second and third growth. But if they look nice, then if they could put them on a calendar or something, that they called that old growth.
Yeah,
a lot of the real old growth wasn't too pleasing to the eye, so they didn't pay much attention to that.
Well, that's kind of funny. So it looks like we have the same, we have the exact same problem where we are in the West. And our difficulty with that is the people in the East don't have that type of timber to harvest. So.
Oh, they do. They do.
Our guys don't
really. New York State is 75% forest.
Right. But when you look at where our lawmakers are, you know, Florida, a lot of these places, I mean, the West is where our huge timberlands are, and they're super rural, so the number of people representing them is really very small. I talk to people all the time on the East Coast, and they'll say, well, you know, that you've cut down all the redwoods. It's like, oh.
Mm.
It's too bad it's 3,000 miles away, or I'd be like, you know, you need to come over and take a look at that.
They grow like weeds.
That's a lie.
You need to come over and get lost in some of these forests.
Yeah, right. That's true, too. Where do you want to start today? You have a three-pager that you wrote last week that we, I think, successfully kept you from talking about. We have 1 minute until our break. Oops. And so how about this? When we come back from our – well, set it up. So when we come back from our break, what are we talking about for the next for the rest of the show, the remainder of the show?
Let's start talking a bit about some of the efforts by the Ford Foundation to recruit all of the philanthropies into their efforts. And I'll start with that, and we get a lead from that again.
Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, this whole thing really does need to be exposed in a really organized way, so we'll do our level best not to derail you, but...
derail me all you want.
Well, people are being...
My whole life
just
in a slow motion train wreck. Come on.
We can derail you without even trying.
People are just being lied to so much about where this is all happening, and they're... I mean, I talk to people every day who believe all this.
In Trump's interview, you mentioned Rand Paul said something about he didn't know who was funding it. In Trump's interview, he goes, it's being funded by some very stupid rich people. But he didn't seem to have any names or organizations to attach to that either.
Which was probably good, because that would give them immunity, because then they'd say that they were just calling hate on him, which is just irritating.
Calling down the hate.
All right. Quick break. We'll come back. We're going to celebrate a little free enterprise, and we'll be back with our guest, William Kay. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at We the People Radio. www.papetmachinery.us.
But good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
There we go. I had a special song for you, William. We will cue that up and surprise you with it. How's that?
Okay.
That wasn't it, though. It was a special one for Canada. This is how you can just let that bubble
oh,
around.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, you
oh,
should
no.
be afraid.
Oh, no. Oh, that's fun. Hey, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a crucial component of what is happening because it explains the motivation of the main funder. And keep in mind, these are not radical people. These are people who simply want affirmative action on steroids. They've already benefited from these programs to a great degree, but they want to keep that gravy train flowing. And part of that is to get more money out of philanthropies in general, to the black movement, and I define the black movement very broadly, you know, organizations that have black in their name, that put the advancement of African-Americans in their agenda. And these affect, you know, health equity. These are groups that want more black nurses. They want better treatment of blacks and black medical treatment for blacks and black neighborhoods. It deals with criminal justice reform. There's 101 issues that they can agitate around, but they typically are fighting for a better deal for black people within those sectors. Now, there's a number of groups, at least three that I know that the Ford Foundation is funding. One is called Race and Equity in Philanthropy, and it's a 800-member networking enterprise that just tries to sort of mingle and network and hold various functions whereby this group can sit down and talk with philanthropists about, you know, upping their budget for black people. There's a group called Racial Equity in Philanthropy Fund, which consists of 17 different nonprofits that more or less keep scorecards on all the different philanthropies, and then they can hound these philanthropies about how much money you're giving to the black cause. But probably the most important of the three is a group called the Association of Black Foundation Executives. And this is a 50-year-old organization. It has 16 directors, all of whom are black. You have to be black to be a director of this organization. And it consists of black people who have got good jobs within other foundations. And they're quite a bit different from the Ford Foundation, which is actually a black-dominated foundation. These people, the 16 members here, none of whom represent the Ford Foundation, are typically, you don't want to use the word token, but they're the only black guy, the only black face that you'll see in these philanthropies. Like the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation has a vice president called Corey Anderson, he's black, and the MacArthur Foundation has a vice president called Kenneth Jones, and he's black. You get the picture. But a lot of the big foundations do have one black guy there who does sort of manage the black portfolio for that foundation. When you have all these riots and all these turmoils, it makes it a lot easier for those people to talk to their bosses and their boards and say, you know, you've got to put more money into the black envelope so that we can quell and sort of meet these people's needs, et cetera. So part of the explanation of this is these philanthropies and the individuals inside them are using this as a means to get a bigger budget next year around. And this applies, you know, all down the line, the arts, in the universities as well. There's all these black studies programs. They didn't exist 40 years ago, and now there's over 100 of them out there at various universities. And they teach, you know, black studies, black history, you name it. And, of course, they almost exclusively hire black people or people pretending to be black people to do it. So it's a way for this.
Like that girl from Washington?
Yeah, there was another one, but this one came out on her own. She probably was about to be exposed. But, yeah, there's a lot of that. It's huge in Canada. It's a huge industry, people pretending to be native. Because you get all kinds of benefits, certainly in the university system, if you can somehow claim to be native. And time and again, you know, they'll give some big award to some native writer, and then a couple of years later, he's exposed as not having a drop of native blood in him. We see that in Canada. And you're seeing that in the States as well. Because a lot of the pressure, you know, the competition to get a professorial job at a university is intense. And there's so many people with PhDs right now. So, if whatever works, you know, a lot of people, you know, Elizabeth Warren, another example. There's a whole bunch of them who fake racial heritages in order to get these positions. And it's what you buy when you actually have preferential treatments for racial groups. You get all this crap along with it. But to see what's really motivating the philanthropists and the ones who are putting, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into black activism, the name of the game is to cause a big fuss and then it's a protection racket, and then go after the big money, trying to get more money out of them. You know, and it's, I was looking at this one guy, his name is James Head. He's the CEO of the Oakland Bay East Community Foundation. $250 million in assets. And you can tell that, you know, he doesn't have a lot of power. He doesn't put in a lot of money into the black movement, but I was sort of going over their annual reports. And there's about 20 or 30 grants that he's handing out every year, you know, to the Prison Radio Project or to Brothers on the Rise or Black Organizing Project, and they're not worth a lot. Like, they're $25,000, $50,000 grants. But then you stand back and think about it. This guy's walking around Oakland, and he's handing out, you know, dozens of grants, you know, to people in Oakland in these poor neighborhoods. He's got a lot of clout. He's got a lot of street cred. Because a lot of these small groups, you know, they really need that, you know, $20,000 or $30,000. Plus, it gives them a lot of imprimatur. When they go to get grants from other people, they can say, well, we got a grant from, you know, the Oakland East Bay Community Foundation. So, you know, a guy like that, even though it doesn't look like he's handing out a lot of money, he's probably only handing out $500,000 a year in Oakland personally. Because he manages this whole fund, but the fund itself is not putting a lot of money into the black movement. So it looks, on one hand, it looks like, well, he isn't really contributing much. And then if you stop and think about it, you know, what does it mean to, you know, to move around a poor neighborhood and be able to hand out checks like that to all those people? He has a lot of clout. He's someone who can say, you know, I want a demonstration on this square at this time, and he can get it done.
Right.
And what I've known from the movement is you don't have to spend a lot of money to get people out.
Yeah,
to get them to show up. Now, is what you're finding, are they paying people directly, or are they just financing the, you know, the
organization.
Pallets of bricks?
They finance the nonprofits.
Yeah.
You know, they don't, like, you know, you're not going to see receipts for bricks and bottles and things like appearing on the annual reports of the East Bay Community Foundation.
I don't know.
It's kind of funny to see that. So they finance a lot of catered meetings. That's crucial in a poor neighborhood. You know, you got to make sure they're well fed, taken care of, and you can get the bodies in the room, and you can sort of recruit from there, and you can sort of pick out the people who are going to be willing to be involved in activism. But you're never going to get this direct, you know, we are paying so much per broken window, so much for damaged car. That's never going to come out. And what I've noticed over the last week, and others have noticed as well, the Black Lives protests are toned down quite a bit. Except for what happened in Kenosha, seems to be a bit of a pulling back, and that seems to be the big money, the Democratic Party, starting to push down on the brake a bit. This is getting a bit out of control, which nothing that Trump said was accurate. He describes stupid rich people are paying for this, but he also says, he said it twice, this is getting away from them. They started something that now they can't quite control, and that's something I noticed as well, and that's going along with now, it looks like there's an effort now to sort of pull back on this a bit. it's a long ways to go before the election. And if it keeps escalating, mayhem by then. And it, exactly. I think it's starting to negatively impact the Democrats.
Well, because people are starting to ask a lot of, even the, you know, some of the broadcasters that don't want to ask, it's become so apparent that if you don't ask, you really do look like you're part of the problem.
Unless you're talking about Portland. Portland seems to be.
Oh, in which case, yeah, all bets are off.
Its own thing.
Yeah, and it's also, if you notice the protesters, they're 99% white.
Yep.
The LA Times had a piece on that today, but a lot of these Black Lives Matter protests, you know, they're overwhelmingly white, and it's starting to look kind of embarrassing. I mean, does it really make any sense that these people would be so angry about what's going on? And it doesn't really make any sense. I certainly have encountered over the years some people that are sort of almost deranged in their anti-racism. You wonder what they're compensating for. These are white people, and their animosity, it seems to be out of step or out of magnitude. With the fact, I mean, I can't imagine getting that worked up and that emotional about it, about events that are happening in other cities. But I've encountered that, and it's something that's coming out of the universities a lot as well. I'm looking at Portland, and I had to go back and check some websites. If you want to get into the mindset of these people, there's one website called It's Going Down. I don't know if she can be putting this on the air. There's another one called Submedia, and there's one called Crime Think, although Think is spelled with a C. If you visit those websites, you can sort of get a glimpse into the mind of the people who are doing this. And I know this community well, and I can say that it is thoroughly bogus. And if there's any anarchists out there, you know, these people in Singapore, I'm sure there's some anarchists in Singapore listening. The key concept is the structure. The tyranny of structurallessness. The word is structurelessness. The tyranny of that. Because when you get involved in these organizations, they brag about how decentralized they are and how they really don't have any organizational structure, etc. Then over time, you realize, oh, they do have a structure. It's just it's not up for grabs. There's sort of a hidden structure inside the organization, and it has set the entire agenda, and it is moving forward, and it masquerades as though there's actually no central control, no central management. That's not at all true.
Well, do you think I think it starts out without a structure, and then as it progresses, I think they realize, you know, we got to get organized, and the next thing you know, they do have a structure.
Well, you get your little playbooks from the Antifa folks and that. But let's face it, the media is completely feeding the narrative, which allows them to continue. We'll be right back with our guest. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Came here to drink. We're all mud flaps and bourbons, all ball caps and turbans, all prom queens and strippers. We're the whole kitchen sink, and in here we're the same. Everyone knows your name. We just raise up our glass. We don't give a rat's ass if you're a Democrat or Republican.
There. I just wanted you to know we're not so different, William.
Yeah, that was a very positive message. Back to these...
We're just trying to be Canadians.
Back to these anarchists.
We'll never be as good as Canadians. We're drinking.
Particularly in the North Pacific Northwest, there's a very old tradition of anarchism. It's where the Wobblies were, the IWW... They've got structured or sort of quasi-structured anarchist organizations going back well over a century there. And Trump actually mentioned that. He was like, you know, Portland's been burning for 100 years. He's obviously getting someone sitting down and explaining to him there's a deeply, deeply ingrained anarchist culture in the Pacific Northwest. Places like Eugene, Oregon, I can't tell you how many times I've met anarchists from that one little city. So it is there. It's structured in that community. It's second, third generation there now. But in terms of the mob, you know, the big black block mobs that they form, what you don't see in there are, A, there's a lot of very well-paid university professors that are involved in this, and they each have their own sort of, you know, coterie of followers that tag along with them, and a lot of them, of course, are trying to get academic jobs as well. You also don't see what I noticed with my involvement in the radical left and the anarchist community is you find a lot of very, very rich people. I met two daughters of billionaires dressed in rags, you know, slumming it with these people, but they were very much part of the scene. And I met several other people as well, and these people have no intentions of spending their lives down with this community. But you do notice them there, and they are very influential in that community. And the third group that you don't notice are the police agents, which are shot through that organization. The American government for a long time has viewed the white supremacist, white nationalist, whatever you call them, as a main threat to social stability. And one of the mechanisms they use to contain that group beyond sort of infiltration, split and wreck operations are groups like Antifa and the Southern Law Poverty Center. And these groups have a remarkable amount of information on the white supremacist community, and they're always doxing them, and they're always harassing them. And wherever those groups try to hold a meeting, these groups mobilize to throw rocks at them and what have you. I can remember back in the day, Antifa, there was forerunners to Antifa. We're always trying to organize, you know, let's go and attack these Nazis. And other people are pointing out, look, there's only six of them, okay? I mean, we didn't, you know, certainly in Canada, there's absolutely no political threat. They're never going to run for office. Why even worry about them? But there was always this element in there that were just absolutely determined to make that the central issue, that every time white identitarians or white nationalists have any kind of assembly, we were all supposed to show up with bats and attack them. You know, and it seemed to a lot of us as a complete waste of time because they're basically a dead end. I mean, odious as they are, they're not going anywhere. There's a potential they might start, you know, splintering off and then shooting people, but there's not really much you can do about that. I think what the explanation of that is that there are a lot of government agents within that, you know, black, you know, people all dressed in black and their helmets and what have you. And it's nothing. It's a typical feature of fascism is that you'll have police involved in like that, and there's tacit approval of the authorities for what they're doing, even though they're clearly breaking the law. Like, how many times have we seen videos of Antifa assaulting someone in broad daylight, and the police are watching it? And that is going on because these things sort of connect at the top. And what the authorities really fear is an uprising of sort of the, you know, backwoods, redneck, racist people. And they put a lot of effort into stopping that. And to some degree, this anarchist community has been co-opted in that. And they're sort of the boot boys for the authorities. Of course, they would never admit that. But that is also one of the factors that's going on. And it just shows how fake they are. You know, for all of their talk about anarchism and what have you, these are groups that are basically run by university professors and cops and by very wealthy people. So there's a real phoniness to them. I mean, I really don't take sides. They say if you see the Antifa fighting the Pride Boys, you're supposed to pray for a meteorite. You're not supposed to take sides. I'm sort of inclined in that direction, but actually I have no you know affinity whatsoever with the other side of that equation either, but it's important to keep that in mind when you see this anarchist movement. There's a lot more going on beneath the surface than appears. But there's also, you know, there's a lot of basically bedrock good people within the anarchist community. I've met a lot of them. These are people who, they ride the rails all over North America. They live in abandoned warehouses. They make their own sort of soup kitchens and what have you, and they're completely off the grid. And they tend to be sort of good people, you know. I attended a Utah Phillips concert one time in a church basement. There must have been 300 people there. When he sang Hallelujah, I'm a Bum, half the crowd knew the lyrics. Oh, that's wow. The Pacific Northwest, okay? Yeah. And it's deeply ingrained in their culture. And I don't really have a problem with them. You know, they make their own bikes, usually run co-op bike stores, and they have these sort of soup kitchens that they create. They're all volunteer run. These people are basically okay. And they're, they're definitely anti-racist for sure, but they're not all that sort of whipped up about this. So, you know, I think America is sort of a big tent place, and there's a place for people like that in there. They're to some extent they're being manipulated and led around by the nose by the sort of other elements mm-hmm. within that community. But I'm not someone who really I know that constituency well, the sort of Pacific Northwest anarchist scene. I know it quite well, and for the most part, they are not harmful people. There are a lot of squatters and things like that, but they live completely below the radar, and you got to sort of respect that. I mean, it's sort of they can get away with it, and they live like that for so long, but I don't really have a problem with them. I see how that they're being mobilized in this action. What's going on in Portland is really never, I've never seen anything like that before, like 100 nights in a row. But once again, we're dealing with a crowd that's probably 95% white, and they're all whipped up into a frenzy about the murder of a black guy halfway across the continent.
Yeah.
Well, the other piece of this that really has to be said, I think people realize it, but never assume. A lot of times the police, if you're talking about city police departments, they're run by the city council. They're not an independent force. They're a department of the city government, no different than the water department or the solid waste department or any of that. They're a department. And so when your boss tells you you're not allowed to do whatever, X, Y, and Z, and that's not in your job description, they don't get to independently go out and... even though it's against the law, and I don't know how you do that as a policeman, but your boss tells you you're not allowed to do anything about it, and so there they are, you know? And there's a lot of that going on in our bigger cities until it gets bad enough, and then somebody says, gee, you know, maybe we should start enforcing the law. I'm not sure how bad that has to get, but I think Ted Wheeler's going to find out, though.
We're just reading a Q&A with Ted.
Yeah, he's watching the machine come after
here. Well, that's the humorous part of that, is they keep attacking him.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, they've got some other candidate, some other mayoral candidate waiting in the wings who declares herself to be 100% Antifa. I think maybe the objective is to drive Ted right out of town so they can have their candidate take over. And I do not know what that's going to look like. If it gets any crazier than this. I should never use the word crazy. But it's pretty wild there right now. And I have seen this article that there was the Antifa candidate for mayor. They've got someone in the wings that is going to be even more of a Ted than Ted. And part of the antiquated structure of Portland is that the mayor is also the top police commissioner. And this is what Ted is now using for his excuse for not speaking out against the rioting, is it would violate his duty as police commissioner because he's supposed to keep all this in-house.
Mm. Oh, I didn't know that.
I did not know that either.
But it sounds like BS to me. Portland does have sort of an antiquated structure. The police commissioner and the mayor are the same person, which is not normal.
Well, yeah. therein lies the problem.
Yeah, you know, there's got to be something else going on there because you know, when he comes out for him in the beginning, and now they're attacking him. He's going
to
be gone.
Well, when he went to that
and they
protest,
will put somebody in there that they like.
Yeah. He goes to the protest, and he's like, you guys are, you know, he's like cheering them on, and then they all turn on him like a bunch of rabid dogs. I have to say, that was a good night of news. I did enjoy that.
Fireworks in the lobby of his as a condo building.
Yeah,
he had to move.
Yeah, how'd you like to be his neighbor? Well, and in most of the other cities, how does it work up where you are? Would they be able to get away with this night after night after night, or are they, and we're just not hearing about it?
The only time I recall this happening was in Quebec. There were some plans to severely cut the education budget, and they had this night after night grinding, you know, but as in Portland, kind of a mild riot. I mean, if you read the history of the world's riots, these ones are pretty mild. I mean, they've had a couple of fatalities. There's been riots where hundreds have died. We had the same sort of thing in Quebec and Montreal, Quebec City and Montreal. It was over educational cutbacks. And eventually the government capitulated, but you had the same sort of thing of just people amassing every night, you know, assailing government buildings every night, and eventually the government capitulated. So there are other examples of that. See the Yellow Vest movement in France, was sort of starting to do that. Like every Saturday, they were showing up. They were showing up in massive numbers.
Right.
And these were, although Yellow Vesters meant other things in other parts of the world, in France, these were mainstream people. It started out as a protest against motor fuel, gasoline prices. And it just escalated just riot after riot.
So
you see, you know, it can happen. There was a city of Regina, where I live, we're holding weekly ban the mask protests. Like, I march against the mask. We don't want to have to wear these masks anymore. And I talk to the organizers, and as of next week, it's going to be a mask burning. Every Saturday, we're going to show up, and we're going to burn these little masks.
Oh,
wow, I hope that takes
the COVID clampdown.
It'll be small fires.
Yeah. Yeah, look what's happening in Germany right now. There are countries where they really are protesting against this COVID thing. It's not even about the COVID virus. It's the response to the virus that's the problem.
Right.
But it does help to have sort of a, but in Portland, what's unusual is it's every night. Like, it's easier for activists to organize something if it's a weekly. But you're asking a lot of people to come out every night. And that's one of their chants. We're here, we're tight, we do this every night. They chant that, and then they go out and create mayhem.
Yeah, and
we're not dealing with thousands, we're dealing with hundreds of people in Portland that are doing almost all of it.
Well, I just wonder how long the business community is going to stand for that. You know, could you imagine? You live downtown, or you run a business downtown, and it blows up every single night?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they usually start kind of late. I don't know. And they have different spots. Like, for the longest time, they were fixated on that courthouse. So it would just really be the businesses around there that would be impacted. I've seen other articles online saying, they're making a point of it, showing, Portland at 2 o'clock at some suburb. And, there's lots of places in Portland you wouldn't even know this is going on. It is fairly concentrated in one area of the city. A lot of Portlanders, if you want to avoid it, you can. You don't have to go down there. You don't have to shop in that area. You could just sort of tune it all out, turn off the radio, and go about your business, and you probably wouldn't even notice it.
No.
So it's a mistake to say that Portland's burning, the whole city's on fire.
Yeah, sure.
It's a concentrated area where it's happening.
Yeah, the bad part is if you get stuck in that part, you're screwed.
Well, and they're moving it around a little bit, too. They're starting to spill out.
They do. They do. They switch it up.
Yeah. The point is they can't stop them. That's the thing. They show up, they do their thing, and then they go away. And it doesn't seem like the police are willing.
They're certainly not getting instructions. Of course, there's always that we mentioned last week. There's a danger of over escalating things. You don't want that crowd to arm any more than they are. And I was surfing a lot of these anarchist websites. And man, they are all arming. And they're all posting stuff about how you've got to start getting weapons, etc. So that is something that is happening in the subsurface, which hasn't happened before.
Right.
So I think to some degree the authorities in the Pacific Northwest are mindful of that. And if they can sort of, de-escalate things, keep in mind, and Americans might not be aware of this, but policing is supposed to be predicated on the doctrine of minimal force. And we can get into this because one of the topics I wanted to talk about is there is a grievance there. I'm noticing all these other groups are popping up, but there's a real problem in America about police violence. And if you want to look at something like, go to the wiki and just look up something like killings by law enforcement officers by country. And the United States is way, way above what any other sort of Western industrialized country is. There are worse countries. I mean, you could be in Venezuela, you can be in Jamaica. There's places where the police killings are just mind-boggling how many people they're killing. But at the same time, the United States is in there with Angola and Iran and places like that. It's killing, I think it's 34.8 people per 10 million a year, per million a year. I can't remember what it is here, per 10 million. Whereas, the UK, it's less than one. I mean, American police are killing 60 times more people per capita than it's happening in Britain. And there's a lot of countries like that. They're killing
I don't think they're allowed to carry guns there, are they? I mean, to kill them, they'd have to pay. paper companies do that, I think, over there.
Oh, yeah.
Aren't they?
If they need them. The regular bobbies don't.
Oh, okay.
But the definitely the police are armed there, as are the criminals. But it's not just the U.K. I could list probably 30 countries in Europe and in the...
Hold that thought, and we'll play the Ted Wheeler theme song, and then we'll be right back with our guest, William Kay. You are listening to We the People Radio.
I don't want you to tell me it's time to come home. I don't care what you say anymore. This is my life.
Oh. All right, that's enough of that.
Kim Carnes, enough of you. So statistically, I didn't really know anybody in Canada carried weapons either.
If you can find the investigation to modern Western industrialized countries, the bar graph would be sort of everybody's at, one or two, and then boom, the U.S., 35, pretendably. So... the U.S. has 150 times more police killings than Japan, 20 times more than Australia, way more than New Zealand. These are sort of countries that in many ways are similar to the U.S., but the U.S. stands out in very stark contrast with lethal police killings. I like what, Rand Paul introduced some legislation about no more no-knock warrants. Like, no more just bust the door down and start shooting. That would be absolutely unacceptable in a lot of these other places. One of the things that Edmonton had, I used to live there, that I thought was a good idea. They have a regular police force, fully armed. They've got a SWAT team, fully armed. And then they have this additional constabulary that's unarmed. And they do a lot of the beat patrols, and they do a lot of the bicycle patrols, and they do a lot of the garden variety, drunken disorderly, shoplifting, domestic disputes. They attend to a lot of those. And they don't have guns. And I think Americans would be surprised at how much police work can be done with you don't really have to have a gun. They just show up. You're just taking a report. You're there at a motor vehicle accident, what have you. And they can do a lot of the work. If they ever get threatened by someone with a gun, they can just stand back, get out of there, and then hit a little button on their radio, and then whoever that was is in a world of trouble now. But there are ways that you could probably get that number down. The smart Republicans... would admit there's a problem here. I mean, the police killings in the U.S. are just astronomically higher than any other modern industrialized world. And what can be done to bring that number down? So a lot of these people screaming in the street, it's not as though they don't have a grievance. They're being exploited. There's all sorts of political factions and philanthropies and what have you that want to exploit this grievance for their own interests. But it's not as though there isn't a problem. There is. I also came across an interesting commentary about, someone trying to explain why this is happening so much in the States. And his theory was that a lot of the police departments hire combat veterans from the Army. And at first blush, it seems like that'd be a good idea. Those guys would make good cops. But in second thought, maybe they wouldn't make good cops because when their conditioned reflexes kick in, they're going to be very likely to draw their weapons and fire. So that was another thought of someone kicking around ideas of how really could they deal with that? Because, it's not as though you don't have a problem. You do. It's being exploited, for sure. But I think the smart Republicans, like Rand Paul, are thinking about ways to really get that number down, to minimize the degree to which the police are using that kind of lethal force. Because it's completely abnormal, I assure you, modern industrial Western world.
I don't know how it is in other states, but I know in California, police officers have to go through post-training. I mean, there's a lot of training you have to go through. And I know people that have applied that were military that did not make it because of exactly what you just said. So I'm not real sure that's a big part of the problem. I think a bigger part.
It might not be.
Yeah, I think a bigger part of the problem is the state of our society today. We have totally lost respect for law enforcement, and that's trickled down to the criminal element that could care less.
Well, we've green-lighted the criminal element. Drugs are okay. All this stuff's okay.
We've turned a lot of these people loose. I mean, there's a lot of problems, I think, that are attributing to the fact that people are getting shot. But I think the number one reason people are getting shot is they're resisting arrest. And if they'd stop doing that, I think
And pointing guns at the police.
I'm pretty sure I'm getting shot if I point guns at the police. I think if you resist and you're combative with the police, someone's going to get hurt. And cops are trained not to get hurt. And so, I don't know. I kind of side with law enforcement a little bit on this one. And I think a lot of it is just the restrictions we've put on cops, the society as a whole has really lost a lot of respect for cops, and this is what you end up with.
Well, a lot of what I find in majority is that people don't know anything about how law enforcement actually works. I always encourage people, if you see that there is a community use of force seminar or training or especially if there's a simulator teaching going on in your community, ask your police department to do that. Use of force training is very, very specific. I sat through one a few years ago where I had a whole bunch of people who were positive the police were just shooting everyone for no reason. And after we went through an entire day of the rules and how it works, they got into the simulator, and it was funny when the criminals pointed the guns at those people, they all shot them. It was like 100% of them shot them. And they all said, oh, my God, I had no idea that's what was going on. Like, that's how that works. It's like, how that works.
No, it's not an easy job, and they have a split.
But it would really help if people had some idea, because they think they're making it up as they go along. It's like, no, far from it. That's absolutely not happening.
No.
And they think that they get to just shoot them and run out and go do their job again. No, there's a whole big protocol for that, too. So, as with a lot of things, I think education
is
really lacking.
An explanation as to why the United States has lethal use of force by officers, 30, 50, 100 times higher than the rest of the industrialized Western world.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Germany, Poland, these places have 5% as much.
Well, do they, I don't know, here, I guess maybe they think they're going to get a break. Speaking of that, oh my gosh, we got to go. Got to do the news, then we'll be right back.
Yeah, we've walked right into it.
Okay.
Sorry.
Bad boys, what you want, what you want, what you gonna do when Chevy John Brown come for you? Tell me, what you wanna do, what you gonna do?
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio here on Sunday, September 6th, 2020. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor is Pape Machinery.
Hit it, Bill.
Yeah, here we go. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Go by and see them. If you need repairs, parts, any of that, just go by. They're located at 3119. I think I just said that. 3119 Twinview Boulevard. Or you can give them a call.
Repeat.
Yeah. 226-9226 or get them on the web at papemachinery.com. My mind was kind of rolling ahead there, and
because we actually made a list of things that we wanted to talk to because we had such a great conversation during the break.
Yeah,
William, sorry you weren't here.
Well, not that we weren't having a great conversation when you were here. Come on, don't.
Oh, yeah, that did kind of come out wrong,
yeah,
didn't it?
Yeah, that sounded bad.
So you can find...
I know, I'm angling for an argument today.
I like it.
So back to the point.
Okay, but hold on. We have to tell them how they can find you. We have to tell them how they can find you. You can find this program, the archives, and all that good stuff for the last 10 years at wethepeopleradio.us. Oh, not actually find you. You got to go to Montana and then go north.
Yeah, go north.
But there's an actual border at Canada, which is something that we don't have on the southern end of our country. And, you know, that is a huge, huge issue for our law enforcement that you guys don't have because you actually enforce your borders.
Yeah, you do a good job of that. I've tried to get in.
We most certainly do not.
Okay?
massive illegal immigration in Canada. They're upping it to 400,000 a year legal, which would be the equivalent of like 5 million a year in the U.S. No, they are absolutely swamping the country with
Are you guys getting it too? Where are they coming in? Just so we can, if we need to get up there, where should we
Planet
go?
Planet Earth. Spin the globe, put your finger down, that's where they're coming from.
Oh.
And the same thing with the wall. You know, I don't know what percentage of your illegal immigrants in the U.S. are not coming across that border. They're just visa overstays. They're flying in as tourists or students or temporary workers, and they're just not leaving. That's what happens in Canada.
Yeah, that's a huge
one. It's not that they're climbing across the border. All that does happen.
Although
they
have them by
the
thousands or had.
Back to my point of smart Republicans.
Yes.
In my humble opinion, smart Republicans would say, yeah, there's a problem. There's an abnormally high degree of lethal force being used by police officers. How can we get that number down? That's why I liked what Rand Paul did about the, trying to get rid of these no-knock warrants, although he got assailed from people who probably didn't know anything about it, but it's not going to save you personally in some circumstances. But, start coming up with ideas where you can really do that. Like, I like the idea of an unarmed constabulary, working certain neighborhoods. They can take care of a lot of these problems. Also, that Jacob Blake that was shot, the guy that got shot 5 times in the back, he was trying to get into his van. If you have looked at the commentary of a lot of the Canadians and a lot of the Aussies and people from everywhere, and they're saying things like, don't these cops play rugby? Don't they play football? In Canada, in other places, there is a presumption that the frontline officer is physically fit, trained in martial arts, and they go in groups. Like someone like Jacob Blake in Australia or Canada, they wouldn't have pulled their tasers out. They wouldn't have pulled their guns out, guaranteed. He simply would have been tackled and thrown to the ground. And I watched that video of the Jacob Blake. The cop has got his gun out, and he's sort of tugging on the guy's T-shirt as he's walking towards his car. Just put your gun back in the holster and just throw him on the pavement. That's the way it is done in most countries.
This would be a terrific debate.
For
where's
some
the
reason,
sheriff when we need
him? Always pulling their guns out.
Well, the other part of that story was the guy was tased, had no effect on him, and he had already punched one of the cops in the face prior to that.
A felon.
Nothing was having any effect on him. And so
forget the Star Trek taser gun.
Right.
Two cops trained in martial arts rushing somebody. I've seen it happen many times. They get them on the ground. Like that's what a lot of the commentary from Britain, Australia, and Canada was like, man, don't these guys know how to arrest somebody? And it seems to me that if you're not physically able to do that, then this work isn't for you.
I don't know, but
a lot of people from outside America looking at that and saying, why didn't they just tackle him and throw him on the ground?
I don't know, because I'm not a policeman. And so, honestly, none of us here have ever been through any of that training and stuff. So, I don't know. We can't adequately respond.
I know, but if the issue is how come America has such an extraordinary, abnormal, high use of lethal force by police officers compared to it's countries like France and Australia, have you.
Tell me this, William. Canada, for instance, because you know that system. In Canada, if you are arrested for a crime of whatever kind, I mean, like something serious, are you held and prosecuted, or are they playing games with your judicial system as well? Because that's a huge factor here. We're kicking lots of
games at the judicial system.
We're kicking lots of violent criminals out onto the street.
Oh, they spend 10 minutes getting signed up and then they release them.
Yeah. I mean, murderers, rapists.
For an hour and then,
you know, I mean, all
I
these.
I don't know about murderers, rapists.
It depends on where you live. A lot of these.
We have a bail system in Canada too.
Yeah, is that changing?
That's another issue. This is a legitimate grievance in the United States.
I get it, but I guess what I'm saying is, it's an absolute contributing factor. When your law enforcement is spending I remember this was a couple of years ago, and we had one guy had stolen, it was 10 cars in the same week, so obviously some of them were on the same day. So the police are constantly getting called to things like that. You've taken all your resources and completely diluted them, so they're not dealing with. They don't have the luxury of dealing with the big crimes. They're one by one by one, and I think in cities like I know San Francisco, Portland, Philadelphia, some of these bigger cities, they've replaced their district attorneys with people who don't want to prosecute. I think we talked about it last week, Contra Costa County. They're going to decide if the person needed the things they stole before they prosecute them, because stealing, I guess, is an arbitrary crime now. As we charge it. You start doing stuff like that, you have a lot of people on the streets that shouldn't be there and have no fear of law enforcement, and they do a lot of scary, dumb things.
Well, there's a flip side to this. I think that bail reform is a legitimate grievance. Once again, it's getting exploited, and once again, there's no easy solution to this. But right now, in the USA, there's 700,000 people sitting in county jails because they can't afford bail. Oddly enough, the person who wrote eloquently about this is a man called Conrad Black. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He used to own half the newspapers in Canada. Hmm. And then he went down to Chicago and he defrauded a whole bunch of investors in some sort of scheme he was planning. And apparently they have laws against that down there. He got locked up in jail. Of course, he always said that he was innocent. But while he was there, he got to talk to a lot of U.S. inmates. And he came convinced that we sort of have a similar thing in Canada that I am aware of. It turns into a guilty plea machine. If you're too poor to make bail, and this is like a third of the population, you are going to sit in that county jail until you plead guilty. And they've almost got a 99% guilty rate in some of these states. You know, a middle-class person gets arrested for a small amount of possession of dope, gets into a domestic dispute, what have you. He's in and out in less than 24 hours. But to a lot of other people, the moment you're arrested, you might as well be convicted at that point, because you're going to sit in jail until you plead guilty. And every time you have a court appearance, they're going to be telling you, look, man, just plead guilty. We'll let you go today. So these people are fundamentally being denied their habeas corpus rights. And it also ties into why they always run away. You know, if the criminal thinks, oh, I'm just going to be in jail for 24 hours, I'm going to have my day in court, I'm going to be able to confront my accuser in an open court, he might be willing to be arrested and taken in.
No, but that kind of blows up when you do the research on it, because in California they blew up bail, have blown up bail in lots of places where these people are still running from the police, trying to grab their weapons, all that kind of stuff. I think you'll find that. You do have a lot of places that still do have bail, but a lot of the ones that are having these kinds of crimes got nothing to do with it. They're still fleeing from the police because they're criminals. And I can hear our former sheriff, he's like, you know, if you watch Cops, like two episodes, you'll see what we deal with all day. They're not, this isn't, you know, they aren't the brightest bulbs on the tree necessarily. And they make bad decisions, which is how they get in these positions. Like, I know that if I do these things, I'm going to jail, so I don't do them. And I think that information's available to everyone. These are actually choices.
This isn't about getting convicted. I mean, a lot of people, whenever there's a fight, I mean, there's two sides to the story. And a lot of these crimes, like possession of dope, it's a very fine line between possession and possession for the purpose of trafficking.
Sure.
Because quite often there's an issue about who exactly was in possession of the dope. But you've got about a third of the population now. The moment you're charged, that might as well be a conviction, because you are going to sit in the jug until you plead guilty. You're undermining the criminal justice system.
No, I agree. I think there's a fair amount of that.
It depends, but I think everyone also knows. I mean, there's a universal truth. If the police tell you to stop doing stuff, that's not the court system. You don't adjudicate crimes with the police. This, you know, you do that after.
So you've created a culture where you know that, you know, getting arrested for a small amount of dope doesn't mean I'm going to be in jail for 24 hours and I'm going to have a day, you know, to be able to plead mercy in front of a judge. There's a big chunk of the population is deeply ingrained in their culture now. You might as well run. There's no penalty for running now. You're convicted the moment you're charged.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no penalty for having small amounts of drugs either anymore. We've got to take another quick break. Imagine that. This just keeps happening to us. Our guest is William Kay. He is somewhere north of Montana. I've got to look him up on a map. He's in Canada, and he's chatting with us about all these different things that are going on in our world today. And you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay. We got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down. We can't hold. We wish we could. Oh no, there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start.
Guaranteed to make your head blow apart. So Robert, that's here in the studio with us, does our website stuff. He was saying that in Canada, and I guess, I don't know, I didn't realize this, but in Canada, when you're arrested, you have to prove you're innocent? Is that how that goes?
No.
Are you?
No, there's a presumption of innocence in Canada.
Oh, okay. All right.
This is the British system. This is habeas corpus.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, we kind of cheated off you guys to make ours.
Okay, yeah. Basically, back in the day, in the Middle Ages, there was a lot of jailers and dungeon owners would capture people and stick them in the jail. And once in a while, a magistrate anointed by the king, who was supposed to be educated, would travel about the land. And he would set up court in various, you know, districts. And habeas corpus meant simply, bring me the body. Don't just come and say, we've got people locked up in the dungeon. Yeah, they're bad people. Trust us. So you bring the person, the physical body, into this courtroom, and that person has the right to confront his accuser in the open court. And it's going to be a judge who's going to determine who's right and who's wrong. That's what you're not giving these people. They're sitting in jail. And they don't, and every time they have a court appearance, they're simply being told, well, look, man, if you would just plead guilty, you would have been released a month ago. And it's a way to squeeze a guilty plea out of people, and people are pleading guilty to possession for the purpose, and they're pleading guilty to, you know, being involved in fights where they might not have, you know, been responsible for it. So what you've done is created a subculture who deeply, deeply, and with some credibility, believe there's no justice in this system. You know, the police officer is not supposed to be the judge,
mm-hmm.
and that's what you've got. So back to being a smart Republican would look for common ground and admit that there's a problem here and would try to come up with creative solutions. What I'm hearing is, you know, how do we apply more brute force to this problem? You know, how can we just, you know, absolutely bash down the people who are complaining about the problem, and then there won't be a problem? No, you've got a real problem, and it's bursting out into the streets. And you're allowing a lot of, you know, charlatans and extremists to exploit this grievance. And the smart Republicans, you know, would come up with solutions. Like, how about a lot more use of those bracelets and things? You know, if you give the guy bail, like if he's just there for shoplifting or possession of dope, okay, we're going to give you bail this time. You got to wear this bracelet. Like, let them, you know, break their bail so many times that you have no choice but to lock them up. But
yeah.
You've got a situation
they use those. I mean, it's not like they don't. What happens is a lot of our policing is done at the local level. So you look at small town USA with a police force of three guys, and you've got to have a whole bunch of people on monitors. It's, I mean, it becomes a just becomes it's like body cams. You know, they've got to store all the footage and stuff like that. So they're all struggling with in the era of technology. How do you grow your budget? Now, what's the thing that all the guys we started the program talking about, all your people burning down the cities, they want them to defund the police. Well, that's going to make all those options less available. Those now become not options.
It's an obviously absurd idea. I mean, you might as well say defund the fire department.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's a ridiculous idea. That's sort of an extremist anarchist position. It doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make any sense to anybody. How could you actually not have a police force at all?
Right.
But as I said, the smarter Republicans aren't simply going to look for brute force solutions, and they're not going to say that there isn't a problem. They should be seeking common ground, not with the people who are trying to make hay of this, but to the general public. There's right now 700,000 people sitting in county jails in the USA because they can't afford bail. And almost every one of them is eventually going to crack and plead guilty. Sometimes they are guilty. Sometimes they're guilty only of a lesser included offense. Sometimes they're not guilty at all. But you're creating a culture there that has no respect for law enforcement. And you might as well run away every time you see one.
Yeah.
So it seems to me, I know bracelets aren't the whole solution. Unarmed constabularies aren't the whole solution. But I think that the smarter Republicans are going to at least acknowledge that there's a problem, and they're going to try to come up with some creative solutions to do it, and they're going to reach out to the aggrieved population over and above the people who claim to represent them. But what I'm hearing more often than not is just, we're just going to hit these people with a bigger hammer, and that's going to be the solution. And it is not working, and you're really undermining the basic fabric of your cities here.
Sure, and the thing is, the part that you're going to hear is going to be at the national level, and this isn't something we don't, let's face it, we've got a big country with a lot of people in it, and to do some one-size-fits-all for a town with 700 people, a city with multiple millions of people, we have a 10th Amendment in this country that allows the states to, and requires the states to take care of certain things. Doing a one-size-fits-all federal thing, and that's like the last alternative we should pick.
I wasn't suggesting that. I was saying that people should start, thinking about solutions to these problems. I think the Republicans are doing themselves a lot of damage. They could take away a lot of the support from the Democrats if they would acknowledge at least that there is a problem and start kicking around ideas in a way you could sort of, how do we get the lethal use of force down? How do we?
Well, and that is being done at the local levels, but like I said, you won't see that in any kind of a national media discussion. I know cities and stuff are working on that.
Trump met with the black leaders here a while back and had a big round table and had a lot of ideas floated on bail reform and justice reform. And, so I don't think it's being totally overlooked, but. William,
the implementation will have to be local.
Yeah, I think you have a point. I think we definitely need to look at different ideas on how to solve this problem because you can't do it with a bigger hammer.
No, yeah, absolutely.
So no, I agree
with isn't
that.
Because it isn't working. So with any, all right. So let's mix our two topics that we started. One that we started with all of our anarchists and that sort of thing with these guys that are supposedly that their focus is to fix the systems. Do you think those people actually care about fixing the systems? And if it started being fixed, would they stop burning the city down? Because I'm seeing those as disconnected.
They have their own agendas. The sort of black movement oligarchy. They're simply trying to aggrandize their budget. And they there's a huge chasm between them and regular black folk. The black movement oligarchy, these are almost all millionaires. Some of them are making over $1 million a year. They're worlds apart, and they have a very mercenary agenda of accumulating more budget and accumulating more resources to what they're doing. Now, keep in mind, the Ford Foundation recently spent $150 million to pay off the creditors for the Detroit Museum, so the Detroit Museum wouldn't have to sell some of their medieval artwork. You know, if you've got $150 million to throw at that and you're not addressing some of the other issues of the black community, that shows you where they're coming from. Okay, they're sort of in a different realm altogether. The anarchists and that old element, though, they are simply exploiting this. They've got a very extremist agenda, actually. It is completely impractical, but they think if they can knock out the police departments, and there's something, they can bring the whole society down. That's what they're doing.
Right.
So there's no accommodating them. Like, this defund police is nonsense. And these other groups, you know, they're using this as a means to get the Democrats back in office. But if you know the history of the Democratic Party, I'm not talking about the ancient history. I'm talking about Biden and Clinton and these people. They were great believers in really tough-on-crime legislation back in the day. And that is one of the things that led to this huge, you know, prison-industrial complex and what have you. You also have to really take a look at, you know, this whole drug war. You know, do you really want this to go on forever? Is this really consistent with the founding principles of your country? Because it is certainly a driving force behind a lot of this crime. I don't know, you know, a lot of these don't have clear solutions, but I think there's a huge mistake to pretend that there's no problem here, that, you know...
I'm not sure a lot of people are pretending there's no problem, because you'd have to kind of be... you'd really have to be...
closed-minded.
There you go. There were things I was going to say that were inappropriate. I was like, oh, can't say that.
Well, that's not the, so a lot of the reportage, I mean, like, you know, Fox News, and if you get the impression that what they, the only problem they see is the protesters.
Right.
You know, it's not, they don't, you know, they're not acknowledging that there's sort of an underlying grievance that has some legitimacy to it.
Well,
or a couple of underlying grievances.
It might be helpful if the protesters were actually protesting underlying grievances and not burning buildings down. I mean, because you, I don't know where I come from, when you start burning buildings down, your message gets lost. like it's lost on me, for instance. Like, I don't want to help you, and I don't want to hear your grievance when you're burning down my town. I think that's happening.
Their thinking is that, you know, that they are disenfranchised, that they really don't have any input into the government system, and that the only way they can get noticed, if they had a peaceful protest, it wouldn't even make page 10 of the local paper.
And I guess running for office is like a lot of work. Probably takes a lot of time, and you got to actually know stuff, and what a drag that would be. We got to take a quick break. What a Weisenheimer. Sorry, my Weisenheimer came out. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Yeah. But the good news is there's angels everywhere out on the street, holding out a hand to pull you back up on your feet. The ones that you've been dragging for so long, you're on your knees, you might as well be praying. Guess what I'm saying, if you're going through hell, slow down. If you're scared, don't show it. You might get out, or the devil even knows you're there. But I still believe what makes a man really has a chance. You've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything. You've got to be your own man, not a puppet on a string. Compromise what's right and uphold your family name. You've got to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything.
Those country guys, they always have the best lyrics. I don't know.
Yeah, I like that. If you're going through hell, son.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that would fit in a variety of our programs. It's so often, but it is frustrating to watch these people say that they have a legitimate grievance when they're coming out at night in riot gear with Molotov cocktails, because it's like, you know what, that's not how you move the needle on policy.
Yeah, you don't get
that isn't where policy
right.
discussions take place. It just isn't. And they can say they're disenfranchised. Well, I mean, who isn't? Right? Get in line. Who isn't disenfranchised at some level or another? I mean, you go to a grocery store and you'd rather have whatever You'd rather have the hours different or something like that. But I'm just thinking showing up and blowing Molotov cocktails through the front window isn't going to keep your grocery store open longer. I mean, you're going to have to go. That's obviously a very simplistic example, but
well, there's a
you got to go do things the right way.
Well, as we discussed last week, there's a whole other substratum to this movement, which are very radical. I just came across a couple of new groups today. There's actually a whole other Black Panther Party, and now there's a Black Panther Unity Party that's trying to unite all the Black Panthers organizations.
And
fractions of them, there's now dozens of these local groups. But there's a substratum to the anarchist movement, to the radical left movement, and definitely to the Black nationalist movement. But yes, they're using these riots to loot, to mobilize resources.
Sure.
They're not robbing these stores to try to change people's opinion.
Right.
They're robbing these stores to get the money so they can buy weapons, buy vehicles, buy safe houses. There are some really hardcore revolutionaries out there, and they are not trying to change anyone's mind. They're actually trying to mobilize an armed insurgency.
Okay, and I just wanted to make sure
so
that we actually got that out there because
this will change people's mind. No, their motivation is, you know, there's $1 million worth of merchandise here.
Well, and you can extort corporations to support you because they're terrified you'll burn their store down. But as we've seen, like, you know, Target gives them money and they burn their store down anyway. Gosh, you could have seen that coming. And somebody
actually want to change their name.
And the logo's bad, too. somebody called in and wanted to know, here's the $64,000 question. What exactly do anarchists... actually, it's not adjusted for inflation, so it's really nowhere. It's in imaginary land sometime in the past. but what exactly do anarchists want? Oh, great. I ruined the show.
There's different strains. Typically, they want a classless society. I mean, you can go to the website of Rose City Antifa. They're anti-communist. They're anti-fascist. They're anti-capitalist. They have a vision of a very downsized society where it's basically small farms, small businesses. Some of them are anarcho-primitivists.
What does that mean?
They have a vision of society where there's no hierarchy. It would all be very small businesses, very small farms. You're not going to have electricity or railways, you know.
So bottom line is Naked and Afraid is no longer a reality series. It's just reality.
I think you're describing the Amish.
Yeah, but the Amish are nice.
They really have a vision of a society where there's no economic hierarchies.
Right.
But it really breaks down into a very primitive society they're talking about. One of the gurus in Oregon is a professor called John Dirtson, and he's one of these primitivists.
How do you spell his last name?
Anarchists will complain about hierarchy, and they'll complain about all these things, but when you really start questioning them about how exactly are we going to reorganize society and preserve, you know, modern technology and modern industry, they say we're not. You know, we really have a vision of a very, very low-tech society, but there's going to be no hierarchy. It's basically back to sort of yeoman culture, except they would be sort of, they wouldn't be patriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
You can get differences of opinion amongst them, but ultimately they have a vision of society that, A, doesn't work, or would only work at a very, you know, low-tech, self-sufficient, voluntary basis. It is really, really impractical.
And what's the guy's name?
That's basically classless society, no state. There's no way to enforce any property ownership other than what you personally own, your own personal sort of space. There's not going to be a police force. There's not going to be a tax department. There's not going to be an Army, Navy, Air Force. And how do you stop the neighboring country from just coming in and colonizing
exactly.
you? Well, they don't seem to have an answer for that either.
Here come the Vikings.
But anarchism has been around for a long time. There are some great anarchist writers it's worthwhile reading their stuff. They have some good commentary. There's a Russian called Bakunin. It's worth reading their books. But when it gets down to the brass tacks of exactly what's this going to look like, you're pretty well surrendering modern industrial society.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely. It's kind of funny, though, that these guys are called the Progressive Party, but really it's all about regressive and go back to... I mean, you didn't just have serfs, you know, and the serfs had a crummy life. Do they, Are they unaware of history?
There was also hierarchy there.
Exactly.
I mean, you're right in the sense that anarchism derives out of a romantic view of the Middle Ages. But the Middle Ages were, you know, grinding.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. I mean, and it's never classless. There is no such thing as a classless society. Has there? There never has been.
There never has been, no.
No.
Not even close.
And the only time I guess we got close was during the plague, and that's because
everybody died. It's important to keep in mind that these people are extreme anti-communists as well. If you look at Rose City Antifa, look at all the, you see like pictures of these anarchists, quite often they'll be flying a flag that has three arrows pointing down in it, pointing down at an angle. That's the triple arrow flag of the Iron Front. And it's a that was formerly a very militantly anti-communist group. So they are very anti-leftist, and quite often they will take offense if you refer to them as leftists.
Oh. So what are the three things? Down with men, down with women, down with furries? Or
down,
what are we talking about?
down with communism, down with fascism, and down with the monarchy.
Oh.
Because this dates to Germany.
But the oligarchy's alive and well.
Just after the November Revolution, there was a lot of effort to restore the monarchy there. So they, the three arrows point at those three. One points at a crown, one points at a swastika, and one points at a hammer and sickle. And these are the three things that they're going to destroy.
Oh, there's actual symbols. Certainly
it is a mistake to refer them as leftists. They do not self-identify as leftists. There is sort of a, some of them do, but the bulk of the pure anarchists, no, they are quite explicitly opposed to anything leftist, capital L leftist. They, of course, have a great affinity with the radical environmental movement because they've got this whole anti-industrial thing going on. They're easily led around by the nose. And for all their BS about being anti-state, time and time again, they're putting out state propaganda. I mean, they're basically tools of the Democratic Party, although they deny it. But they are.
But they
are quite a social force on the ground in the Pacific Northwest and other weird cities like Salt Lake City, and that they have these large anarchist movements in them. And a lot of these people, they've dropped right below the radar. As far as they're concerned, the whole thing can go to hell, and they're going to survive.
Wow. The cockroach movement. they're going to make it no matter what. Yeah. Well, I guess if you look at their little social experiment.
They're experiments. Experts in how this ground food. You know, I'm impressed by their ability to ride around on the railway tracks. I've talked to some of these people, and they have been all over North America riding on freight trains.
Wow. Well, you look at what they did in Chaz or Chop or whatever they are. I mean, that didn't last but a millisecond, and they ate themselves. So their classless society, they had to have toilets brought in. They had to, you know, beg for kale and whatever all else it is that they eat because they couldn't grow it themselves. If they think they have a vision of how the world works.
They planted a garden, but I don't think they understood it was going to take a few months to really actually grow anything.
Yeah.
They're great on community gardens, these sorts of things. They think they can actually survive on this sort of stuff.
They're
great at tearing things down. And if, you know, back to the Russian Revolution, you know, the Bolsheviks and the anarchists were great allies until the revolution happened. And then the anarchists started to assassinate the Bolsheviks. And then the Bolsheviks just wiped them out. But that was sort of a thing there. They're great at tearing down a society, but they will not allow any other group to form a government. They're not anywhere near that now. I don't know how powerful they're getting. If they really arm, they do number in the thousands in the Pacific Northwest, they could really start causing bedlam. And keep in mind, they have no sense of rebuilding it. All their propaganda is about tearing this down, burning this down, and they think that somehow once it collapses, that we're all going to be, you know, dancing in the ruins of multinational corporations. And they, you know, it's impossible to get them to practically discuss exactly what that's going to look like after you do this. They're not interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow, kind of a one-sided plan. We've got the party, but no cleanup crew. Terrific. That's what we all need. We need more people who are half planning.
Ideologically, they're no threat, really, but you know they're amassing on the ground. They're playing on people's grievances. You know, they're playing on, but they're quite fanatical. I've met some of these people, and they are quite fanatical.
And so, when you ask them where it's going in the future, when we come back, I'd love to hear how that conversation goes, because I think we're all the rest of us that don't talk to these people are all thinking, what goes through their head? Like, how do they think this is going to turn out? So maybe when we come back, you could give us a little more on that, if there is anything, besides just the wind whistling through their ears. You're listening to We the People. Please join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
That I was right out of my head, the way he described it. He said I'd be better dead than alive. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along that he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought I was crazy, but I'm not, oh no. My analyst told me that I was right out of my head. He said I'd need treatment, but I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined, when out of his sight, to be out of my mind. And he thought I was nuts, no more ifs, or ands, or buts. They say as a child I appeared a little bit wild with all my crazy ideas, but I knew what was happening, I knew I was a genius. What's so strange when you know that you're a wizard at three? I knew that this was meant to be.
I couldn't think of anything better to lead into that question than that song. So honestly, how do they think this is going to turn out? Do you ever ask them that?
Yeah, well, they don't, like a lot of extremists, they don't put a lot of thought into what is going to happen after. They're more... And they'll say that they're into the struggle, they're into mobilizing people in the here and now. And there's a phoniness to it, and you always got to wonder, you know, who's really driving this thing. I can just mention some other websites. The only thing I noticed with some of their websites is they're highly professional. Like there's one called the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, and this once again is a sort of, these ones are kind of unusual, but once again very militant, very heavily armed, intermingled with some of the, there's one group called the New African Black Panther Party. They're mingled with them. There's a go to the Rose City Antifa website. There's no danger of you saying, oh my God, you get sucked into this thing and start believing it. There's really nothing there. And there's always something suspicious about these groups. You know, I think there's some money coming into them from somewhere that's propelling this thing forward. And they're a little too slick, they're a little too organized to be doing what they're doing, to claim to believe what they're believing. But in general, they're almost a Luddite organization. A lot of them are great followers of the Unabomber. In fact, that Professor Zertsen, who's got this huge cult following in Oregon, he frequently visits Kaczynski in prison and brings back word from Kaczynski to these people.
How do you spell that guy's last name, the professor? That you've referenced.
What's that?
Professor John, what? How do you spell his last name?
Zertsen. Zerzen. John Zertsen. He has an enormous cult following in Oregon. Make sure I'm spelling that right. John Zertsen. But once again, he's an anarcho-primitivist. He even questions the development of agriculture. We should all go back to being hunting and gathering people. I mean, it's idiocy.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well,
and
where would he be a professor?
A well-paid professor.
Where is he a professor?
I'm looking at his Wikipedia page.
Huh?
There's John. He's got a number of books out.
Okay.
He educated at Stanford.
Terrific.
I don't know where he's teaching now. San Francisco State, I think. Hmm. Or maybe he's up in Salem, so maybe he's teaching up there. But no, this is like a lot of them, you know, where else? Stanford, right? Where else would you produce this nonsense? But he's really big. He's got a number of books out. But a lot of them are sort of along those lines. but they're out there, out and about. And, like, they can be manipulated, too. And they do, once again, there's a huge grievance out there around housing in America. There's simply inadequate housing. A lot of people believe that if you just open up a lot more land for development, it would solve the problem. Maybe public spending is going to solve the problem. Of course, all the anarchists are going to come up with is sort of eviction defense, try to encourage squatting, encourage non-payment of rent, and try to mobilize a flashpoint there. They're looking for trouble. They're looking for reasons and mechanisms by which they can cause class conflict or conflict between the police and the citizenry. They're not here to help. They're here to destabilize things. And their hope is that they can sort of knock out the props of the system, kick out the jams, and the whole thing will come crashing down. And out of the ruins, out of the ashes, this classless utopia will emerge.
Spelled Thunderdome.
Yeah, I think we saw Tina Turner star in that. Yeah, good point, Bill.
Yeah. Wow.
No, I've never been an anarchist. I've had my dalliances with the radical left. I was also a central organizer of the libertarian movement for a while in Canada. But the anarchists know it never made any sense to me. But people are passionate believers of it. I think a lot of them were, you know, unable to embrace other ideologies which were prohibited. So they sort of glommed onto that, but they're basically being manipulated. They're sort of the Luddite movement, the anti-industrial movement, it has a lot of support in high places, and they're sort of a spin-off of that. But you also have to realize that the anarchist tradition goes back, you know, 150 years, 160 years. They've been organized that long. They've had their own printing presses for that long. They've been a structured institution in Oregon for well over a century.
Well, you told us last week about the origins of Antifa. Remind us of that, because that goes way back as well.
Well, there's in Germany during the rise of the Nazi Party, the period from the November Revolution, 1918, to January 1933, is the movement where you see the rise of fascism in Germany, and there were opposition to it. The Antifa there. The anti-fascist movement, there were two of them. One was the Triple Arrow group, which was an offshoot of the Social Democratic Party, which is sort of like the Democratic Party, but they were also very anti-communist. And then there was the anti-fascist move, which was organized by the German Communist Party. That has been completely erased. The German Communist Party was annihilated. They were the first people rounded up. The first concentration camp in Germany was for them. They were annihilated quickly. So the group that resurfaced in the 1970s, took the name anti-fascist, but there was no organizational connection between them and the German Communist Party. The first group to use that phrase was in Sweden in the 70s, and it sort of travels around there, but by other names. In the United States, once again, Oregon was the center of it. The group Rose City Antifa existed before it took that name. It had existed for 20 or 30 years, but around 2005, they formed a group called Rose City Antifa, the anti-fascists of Rose City, and they pretty much set up every chapter of Antifa in the United States. Mm-hmm. They are sort of the central organizing hub of it. And just visit the website, Rose City Antifa, and they'll tell you all about themselves. And once again, you know, this is kind of a slick website. They're well organized. They don't seem to have a budget. They're absolutely obsessed with attacking white supremacists. They remind me a lot of the Southern Poverty Law Center. They're the websites, you wouldn't know which website you're looking at. So they're obviously being drawn into this really state-sponsored campaign to monitor and control the white supremacist movement. But there's a 30 or 40-year break between the original anti-fascist group, which was an adjunct of the German Communist Party, and these things that developed later, which were not in any way attached to the communist movement. This was exclusively an anarchist movement. They took the name. They took there's a red and black flag they sometimes fly, and they more commonly fly that Triple Arrow flag. But this was something that emerged actually in the 60s and 70s and really adopted this name 15, 20 years ago. And, no. And once again, that Oregon, Portland, Oregon, ground zero. ground right. zero of the entire America Antifa movement.
And is, have all the separate branches or organizations of Antifa, are they pretty together on their messaging, or have they kind of split apart a little bit?
There are these factions. Like the group that you might want to watch is that Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement. That's one, again, it's an anarchist splinter group off of this. Their messaging is very similar. They all call for a classless society. They all are obsessed with attacking white supremacists. They have almost an idolatry of black people, even though they're all white themselves. They're quite explicitly almost anti-white racist, even though they're white themselves. Yeah, there is a very, there's definitely common threads amongst the half a dozen concentrations of anarchists out there, and they all overlap with Antifa. They are basically the same people. There are deep divisions within them, but boy, you'd have to really join them and really go to meetings that that last for 10 hours that I really couldn't be bothered to do. But I recommend going to the website It's Going Down, the website Crimes Think. It ends with the letter C, the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, and Rose City Antifa. If you spend an evening sort of surfing around those websites, you'll come away with a pretty clear idea, although you won't hear of a single person's name. They are very secretive.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you that. Who's the leadership? They don't mention that.
Mm-mm.
Zero. You will never get a name from these people. The only way to get the names of these people would be to visit white supremacist websites, because these groups are very busy doxing each other.
Ah, okay.
And mark my words, within a few months, the doxings are going to turn into assassinations. These people just absolutely hate each other.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's...
And doxing is very close to assassination. Like, well, we know where you live, you know, we know, et cetera, et cetera. Here's your photograph. Here's you walking into your house. They're already doing a lot of that back and forth.
Hmm. Wow. Well, so things are probably going to get worse before they get better. How amazing. Our guest has been William Kay, and we love chatting with him. He's up there in Canada in Land of the Free.
Regina, Saskatchewan.
In Saskatchewan. So go look
there
that up.
Well, as
Montana
things develop,
and north.
As things develop, William, keep in touch. We'd love to have you back on. Always fascinating.
And his website is ecofascism.com, and it's really got a ton of information. And yes, I'm sure we'll chat again soon. You've been listening to We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.